From Iowa Public Radio, I'm Janine Beck, and this is The Exchange. Earlier today, more than a dozen newly elected Republicans were sworn in at the Iowa State House during the opening of the 2011 legislative session. It's a huge class of freshmen, which includes members who are brand new to politics and familiar faces who've returned after an absence from the Capitol. This hour on The Exchange, observations from two newcomers and a veteran legislator. Also, a discussion of the GOP's Taxpayers First Act, which proposes significant budget cuts. The list includes state-funded preschools, cessation programs, and university sabbaticals. It halts out-of-state travel and new car purchases and requires state employees to pay a fee for health care. Republicans argue voters are clamoring for these changes, while Democrats are promising to block those they find most objectionable. Hear from both sides next on The Exchange, but first, the news. Good afternoon. I'm Janine Beck, and this is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. The GOP now holds a staggering 20-seat majority in the Iowa House, while Democrats hold a slim 2-seat majority in the Senate. Many who were sworn in just this morning are brand new, but there are some returning members coming back to long-held posts after an absence. Joining me for the first half of the program today, newly elected Republicans, Representative Chip Baltimore of Boone, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
And Representative Jeremy Taylor of Sioux City, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also, one of those that we talked about who has had an absence but is back, a former representative, now Republican Senator Sandy Griner of Kyoto, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about the differences between those of you who have just joined today and somebody who has served in both the House and Senate before and is now back in the Senate. Let me ask you first, I'll start with you, Representative Baltimore. You came in by a razor-thin margin.
Yes.
The recount. When you were sworn in today, what was that? What did that feel like to join this body?
Well, I think it was a culmination of a lot of hard work by a lot of different people in my district. Demographically, the district that I ran in, District 48, did not favor Republicans and has not favored Republicans for a lot of years. Today certainly could not have happened without the hard work of so many people that were eager for a change. So it was very rewarding in that aspect, not so much for me, but really for the people that I represent back home.
But speaking of that thin margin and what you said, that the district has not traditionally been a Republican district, how does that shape the way you govern and how you vote? Are there issues in which you believe you'll be, you know, backing your party, or are there some issues, though, where you say, look, my district might have a different feel for that issue?
I think that will just play out over the course of the session. It's far too early for me to sit here and draw lines in the sand as far as what our positions will be on certain things. I think the main thing that I hope to accomplish here is to be a good listener. Listen to the people back home, listen to what they want this legislative body to accomplish, and then turn around and listen to the voices of my colleagues in both the House and the Senate so that we can try to get some good things accomplished.
Mm-hmm. Representative Taylor, I watched one of your commercials before the program today from back during the November campaign. You're a school teacher, member of the National Guard, small business owner. Your ad was one of the few positive that I had seen in this fall campaign. You focused on wanting to reduce the size of government and then therefore reduce property taxes. Is that your priority, or what? Tell me some of your priorities as
you come in.
Absolutely.
One of my main priorities is to get a hold of this budget. I think that I'm in a very Democratic district. Also, 12 of the last 16 years, Democrats have controlled the district. But I won by a large margin because there are some issues that I think that we can center around that Iowans come together on, and that is that Iowans want to get a control on this budget. They don't want to spend more money than we take in. They don't want to have us kick the can down the road and use one-time money for ongoing expenses. They don't want the specter of having our children and our soon-to-be grandchildren, and in my case, a few years down the road, to have to foot the bill. And so I think the budget is going to dominate early on, but also job creation. I live in Sioux City, and we have to compete with South Dakota and Nebraska. Now, if Iowa is going to remain as the fifth worst business tax climate, cities like Sioux City and Council Bluffs and other cities on the eastern and southern borders aren't going to be able to compete. And so I ran hopefully a a fairly positive campaign on sparking economic growth through good job creation and lowering the tax burden on businesses.
I know we'll have a Democrat on in the next half who would also point to other surveys that talk about the business climate in Iowa. There's Forbes rankings that rank it pretty high, but being on a border community has definitely had an impact on, as I've watched lawmakers serve, when they worry about competing with a state next door. The governor has proposed commercial property tax reduction. But if you've watched this body before, you know that property taxes are always a concern, but nothing happens. What makes you optimistic, or are you optimistic?
Well, I think we need to take a strong look. And I hear this argument go back and forth where people talk about, well, how are you going to afford that tax reduction? But I think we need to think of it in terms of a thermostat or a threshold, so to speak. At what point can you lower those commercial property taxes or some of those onerous taxes on business and draw more businesses in so that it's actually a net gain? In other words, if you have more taxpayers, cumulatively, you're going to have a better system. You can actually increase revenue. So we need to look at that threshold and where can we lower that? It's not going to happen overnight. We didn't get in this situation overnight. But incrementally, where can we make changes so that we can draw more businesses to Iowa and have more taxpayers ultimately?
All right. Senator Greiner, you were first elected to the House in 1992. You went over to the Senate in, was it 2001?
2000.
You were there just 2 years because of redistricting, and then you were forced in with another senator. Is that what I'm remembering?
Three incumbents were thrown into that district, yes.
Yeah, so you went back to the House, mm-hmm. served until 2009, and retired. Mm-hmm. What brought you back to us?
Total outrage at the way my grandchildren's future was being squandered away. To me, it's all about the budget. And if the way you get the budget back in line is to reduce spending and to create jobs so you have more taxpayers in the area. So the budget and jobs are the things that brought me back. I just felt that something had to be done with the outrageous way money was being spent.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're back in a year in which we're going to do redistricting again. The legislature will be the Legislative Services Agency, the nonpartisan bureau, will be giving you near, I think, March, April, some maps to look at, redistricting maps based on the census count. It's very possible you'd be tossed in again. How do you feel about that? I know I'm the opening day of the session, but it's a realistic possibility.
It's not something that I'm concerned about. Whatever happens, happens. You know, it's we have to reapportion ourselves every 10 years in order to keep the same number of people within each district, and it's a part of the process, and it's not something that I'm concerned about, not because I think something good is going to happen or something bad is going to happen. I just think that we need to keep our eye on the prize and do what we came here to do rather than be worried about protecting ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Representative Taylor, I saw in that commercial that I mentioned earlier on the program, 5 children, I think it was, running toward you. Are those your children?
I have a 6-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 1-year-old, and then I had 2 nieces and a nephew that were living with me at the time.
All right, so this is the big day when you're sworn in. Did
Absolutely.
Family come?
Yes, they did.
All right. And have you gotten lost yet in the building? I mean, tell me about these. The
Many
first
times.
All right,
yes, but I always keep my eye on the bathroom on the lower level, and if I know where that is, then I'll feel that I'm okay. And if I get lost and need to ask directions from somebody like Chip or Sandy, then that'll be great.
Yeah, but maybe go with Sandy as opposed to the new
It's probably a good idea.
What's Representative Baltimore, what's been the biggest surprise on the first day, or have there been any? Or best advice you were given?
I think snow was the biggest surprise. But I think the best advice that I was given was by Speaker Paulson early on. And that's that this is a marathon, not a sprint. We can't just come in with all of our ideas and expect that they're immediately going to be accepted by everyone and everything's going to happen right away. So, it's important to get your ideas out there and make sure that you build consensus around them and see what you can accomplish in that manner. So I think that's probably the best advice I was given. Today was just a fantastic day. I don't know that there was anything that was terribly surprising other than just a confirmation of the excitement and enthusiasm that's around the building today.
Senator Greiner, as someone who's been sworn in many times before, what advice do you have for a newcomer?
Well, having been a newcomer a long time ago myself, and having watched hundreds, probably, of new people come through the rotunda and be sworn in, I think the most important piece of advice I could give any incoming freshman, regardless of their party, would be to sit back and learn the process and to not get up and speak on every issue, every bill that comes along. When you talk too much, you lose your credibility. When you speak on only a few things, people, because you don't talk all the time, they sit back and they watch and they listen to what you have to say. If you talk every day, you pretty quickly lose that effectiveness to have people really key in on what you're saying.
For you, that's largely been the pork industry, because you're a pork producer from Southern Iowa, and you have been a champion of that industry and of those in the business like you. I know with some disease issues, you've had a large impact on trying to protect the pork population from that. I mean, what do you see then as a priority for you returning? I know you talked, though, about the budget, but because agriculture has been a key issue for you, is there something there that you look for in this upcoming session?
Well, let's face it, if we fix the budget, that will be helpful to agriculture as well as to everyone else. So the budget need and those jobs need to be the priority. And to say, well, I only want to do this for the pork industry, or I only want to do this for some other industry, that's all wrong. This is all about Iowans, and it's all about fixing the budget and creating jobs.
Mm-hmm. Are there issues, environmental issues, that you think you'll need to oppose to protect your industry?
I haven't taken a look at the pre-filed bills. I'm no longer involved in the environmental committee, and so I'll just be kind of watching from afar on what comes down the pike. I don't have knowledge of anything that is coming down, but I'm sure there will be something.
Mm-hmm. Representative Taylor, three of your freshmen or fellow freshmen are drafting articles to impeach the remaining Iowa Supreme Court justices. Talk to me about your position on that. Is that something you're going to support as a new member if it does come up for a vote in the House?
Well, I do sit on the judiciary, and I will listen if articles of impeachment are brought, and I will carefully consider out of due respect to my fellow members. That is something, however, that I think we ought to be very hesitant about, and we ought to be very judicious and look, does the particular decision of the Supreme Court justices constitute malfeasance? I think that we ought to look very carefully to the Constitution, even if we believe that in this instance our justices did not. And so I will, out of due respect, I will listen to the arguments being made. But again, I'd be very hesitant. But let me just also say this. The real issue and the reality is that concerning marriage is that Iowans are not being given the chance to vote on this issue. That's where I want to keep focused. And really, it's because of one senator, and that's Senator Gronstahl. And so what I would hope is that he would do the right thing and give Iowans a chance and put the Democrat back in Democratic Party and let people vote. That's simply what they want. And this could all be avoided if he believed ultimately that people should have the right to vote on this, as we believe.
And so would it be your position, and I'm not trying to take things out of context, but that it could be that retention is different than malfeasance. You might vote not to retain someone, but that may not be the same as voting to impeach them. You might say, well, we didn't agree with their decision. We felt they should not be retained. However, that may not be malfeasance. That may be, or what do you think?
Right. Well, I think that's one of the discussions to have is, obviously, in a year, and I think this is interesting, when we had Democratic congressmen retained, when you had a Democratic attorney general and treasurer, in that same year, you had 56% of people say, we do not want to retain those three judges. So the argument may be, look, the people will make the decision ultimately whether to retain or not, whether or not the people want the legislature to impeach the justices, that may be a different story. But again, I think the issue comes back to ultimately, are we going to allow people to vote on this or not? And unfortunately, I don't think Iowans haven't had their voice heard. And I'm really hoping, again, that Senator Grunstell will do the right thing and recognize that his voice is not as important as 3 million Iowans.
Mm-hmm. Representative Baltimore, let me ask you, have you formed an opinion on that yet, or has that been on your radar?
It has been on the radar, and I would concur in what Representative Taylor said wholeheartedly. It's important for everyone's voice to be heard in the process, and it will be a matter for the representatives to consider whether or not the case for impeachment has been made. But that being said, I spent a lot of years in the judicial system.
Mm-hmm. You're an attorney.
I am an attorney. Spent several years in private practice and still practice in-house for a bank. So I have a great deal of respect for the independence of the judicial branch, and I think that respect is something that we need to keep in mind, not just constitutionally, but also just inherently in the system. And you can have respect even though you may disagree. And I think that's something that's so important.
Let me ask you about that coming off a really difficult election, though, in which people were very fired up on both sides. And Republicans have such a large majority now in the House. Do you feel any obligation to listen to the minority party? Or do you sort of feel like, look, we came with a mandate from voters? How do you take that election?
Well, I think it's important, very important, to listen to everyone who wants to have a voice in the system. As Senator Greiner mentioned earlier, sometimes it's better when legislators kind of stay quiet on some issues rather than having a voice on everything. But again, listening is probably the most important thing that we can do as representatives, and whether it's listening to our constituents or listening to other legislators. That's to me is something that I think is the key to having respect for each other and having respect for other branches of government.
Senator Greiner, you were president of the board of the American Futures Fund, which ran ads. It targeted certain Congress members across the United States, and one of them being Bruce Braley. Do you feel like your involvement with that organization will make it harder for you to reach across the party lines here now back at the State House, or will that not have an impact?
Probably not. Wouldn't have any more impact than the, $500,000 worth of negative ads that were run against me. How is that going to work for them mm-hmm. to reach across the aisle to me?
Do you feel, I know you raised eyebrows when I talked about this being a very negative campaign. Do you feel like the two parties can come together during this session, or are things so fractured or so, I mean, it used to be that once the session started, we heard those speeches this morning. Usually they're pretty warm and fuzzy, sort of a reach across the aisle. But after a tough campaign, is that hard to do?
I think it is difficult to do, especially when they get personal. Mm-hmm. You hesitate to reach out there because you're not really sure whether they're going to claw at you or whether they're going to, welcome your assistance. So we'll let that play out.
Has that changed? Because we've talked about how you've served since 93. Has that changed over the course of years? Has it gotten more contentious?
We'll have to wait and see. The Senate has never been as contentious as the House has. The House, by nature, seems to be a little more aggressive, a little more exuberant, and the Senate is very deliberate, very laid back. So we'll see how that all works in the Senate. I think most of us that were involved in the really negative campaigns have been at this a long time. There was a reason they had to be so negative, because they wanted to try to stop us. And we all understand that. We've been at this a long time. So, can you put it behind you? You certainly can. All pros do that. You just, cast it aside, but you don't forget it. Mm-hmm. And you remember what they're capable of doing. So, Well, just let it play out and see what happens. I'm ready to go to work, and we'll see if they are.
Mm-hmm. Representative Taylor, let me ask you. I know that across the country there were certain elections, certain races in which the Tea Party movement had some nice pull for Republicans. Their involvement there, sort of excitement maybe, kind of ginning up the base again might have had some help. Do you guys feel like there was any Tea Party movement in your own districts, or do you feel like they had any ideas that are going to be worth supporting now that you're elected?
Well, I think the ideas are very important. I don't know of the organized mm-hmm. Tea Party per se within my own district. But what's more important is that the ideas that the Tea Party is talking about are being appropriated by not just Republicans, but also independents and some Democrats who say, look, we want a real balanced budget. We don't want to shift funds from one place to another or create a balanced budget like we did, or let me say the legislature did, by rolling $231.1 million onto property taxpayers. That's not our idea of a balanced budget. And I think that the Tea Party movement is helping because people coalesce around those ideas, even though it might not be so formalized. I can't point to, you know, groups or within my own district, but I think the sentiment is out there and it's helpful.
Mm-hmm. Representative Baltimore, I know it's the first day and I don't want to bring anyone down on the very first day, but how soon? I know that sometimes new members, especially freshmen, are, you know, there is a feeling of camaraderie. I remember several years ago, there was a group of freshman senators from both parties who sort of banded together, started having dinner together once a week, once a month, and felt like they were going to be bipartisan, and they really did hold together on a couple of issues. Do you feel like that today, or do you feel already that sort of pull of, I've got to be reelected in 2 years? I mean, when does that sort of realization set in that I've only got 2 years and I have to do this all again?
I have no idea when the pull, if any, will come regarding reelection. I was elected to do something now. And to work hard over the next 2 years to do the work of the business of governing for the people in my district. We have no idea what redistricting is going to bring. We have no idea what life holds before us. So it is far, far too premature to think about reelection at this point, and that thought has not entered my head, at least. But I am looking forward to getting to know many of my freshman colleagues, as well as some of the more experienced representatives and senators here in the Capitol.
Tomorrow is the condition of the state. It will not be delivered by a Republican governor because, as is the tradition, the governor of the previous year is going to be delivering the condition of the state. That will be Governor Chet Culver. Any of you quickly want to jump in? And is there something you'd like to hear from the governor, Representative or Senator Greiner?
Well, I haven't really given that a lot of thought. I'm sure that this will be the final time that we hear from Governor Culver. And so I haven't given a lot of thought as to what it is he'll have to say. I'm sure that he will address the things that he feels have been his accomplishments, as well he should. He's been a public servant for 4 years, and he's entitled to put those out there.
Are you guys excited about tomorrow? There's a lot of pomp and circumstance involved.
Absolutely.
Yes, it'll be great.
It'll be interesting. All right, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Good luck in your first term, Senator. Good luck in returning to the State House. We've been speaking today with Representative Chip Baltimore of Boone and Representative Jeremy Taylor of Sioux City, both Republicans, and returning Republican, now a Senator, Sandy Greiner of Keota. When we come back, we're going to speak with a Republican and Democrat about the Republican plan known as the Taxpayers' Rights Act. We'll be back in just a moment on The Exchange. Good afternoon. This is The Exchange, and we're live from the Law Library of the State Capitol Building on the opening day of the legislative session. I'm Janine Beck. Last week, House Republicans rolled out the first bill that they plan to introduce this session, the Taxpayers First Act. It creates a fund to capture any remaining general fund surplus, basically any money that is left over from the previous year. That it also calls for hundreds of millions of dollars in reductions in spending. And I have a list of those we'll go over in just a few minutes. But I want to introduce our guests for this half hour. House Speaker Pro Tem, Republican Jeff Kaufman of Wilton. Thank you for being here. And Senate Appropriations Chair Bob Dvorsky, a Democrat from Coralville. Senator, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Representative Kaufman, Congratulations on Speaker Pro Tem just this morning.
Thank you. It's still fresh.
It's still fresh. Talk to me about this Taxpayers First Act. What is the idea behind it? What's the goal?
Sure. I mean, I think first and foremost, the overriding goal is to make sure that we put into place and put into play in the legislature the campaign promises that House Republicans made. One of the campaign promises was to make sure that our budget is sustainable, to make sure that that government does not continue to grow, but rather move back to an area where it is sustainable. We're also obviously with the fund for tax dollars beyond the residual funds that we need to fill up the various funds in the legislature. We are trying to come up with a situation where we can get some relief back, some property tax relief, potentially other areas. And then another third element of that, Janine, is to try to make sustainable our mental health funding system. We put a Band-Aid on the waiting lists at this point and take care of that issue and then move into a full-blown review and a potential reform. So those would be the three areas I think that are important.
Mm-hmm. And you hold a pretty sizable majority in the Iowa House, a 20-seat majority, 60-40. But in the Senate, Democrats still have a two-seat majority. Let me just tick off a couple of the things on this list, and let me throw out the phone number as well, because if you have a question about this list of proposed eliminations, we want you to call us today and tell us whether you agree with some of these. 1-866-780-9100. Again, that number, 866-780-9100. Of course, you can also email us at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. The list includes charging state employees a fee for health insurance, prohibiting new vehicle purchases, selling or leasing the ICN, cutting some library acquisition funds for the universities, ending university sabbaticals. One of the interesting ones is combined administrative functions at the three public universities. And I wanted to ask you about that. Representative Kaufman, what does that mean, combining administrative functions?
Trying to find ways that right now we have three presidents, we have three administrative structures, trying to find ways that we can collapse those administrative structures into one. Are there areas among the three universities where they could share? We don't necessarily want to prescribe what they share. We don't necessarily want to prescribe how they do this. What we're trying to prescribe is, can you step up and find those particular savings? On the sabbaticals too, Janine, I wanted to mention, that is a moratorium, not ending it. So we're asking for a moratorium on those sabbaticals for a time. So
and you're a college, you're a community college professor. Talk to me about these, this idea of sabbaticals. College professors will often say they're invaluable, they learn, that helps them relay new information to students, or it helps them reinvigorate themselves, because it's sort of a same old job in the sense of often giving out the same information year after year. But you're, why put a moratorium on those, then?
We were trying to find some ways within the budget that would be, that would least affect students and would still have a positive impact in terms of our budget, making it sustainable. What I've told the universities all along, I mean, I'm a person, I wrote my PhD while I was working, while I was teaching full time. I mean, I appreciate the renewal, but I'm hard pressed to explain to the people in Bennett, Iowa, why studying the effects of yoga during these time periods is a necessity. And so I, what we're asking is for the universities to step up. If these sabbaticals are so crucial and so important to the learning, then give us something else. We've consistently said, if there's some ideas in here you don't like, come up with something else. We don't have anything. And so if we're not getting any help in this situation of trying to find where to cut the budget, then we're going to make those selections. As a college teacher, I have no problem with the moratorium, but if they don't like it, then come up with something differently for us.
Senator Dvorsky, the legislature has been hard-pressed to combine local school districts over the years because of the sort of feelings that people have about their community
Slowly,
school.
Slowly, the numbers are shrinking.
They are shrinking, in part because maybe there's been some political pressure. Some districts have started to combine services, wondering if that would eventually come down the pipeline. Do you think the universities will start saying, okay, if we don't share some services, it's going to, we're going to get a mandate, let's do this?
Well, I think they've been sharing services for years in a number of areas. And if we step back a little bit and look at last year when we did started moving forward working on our reorganization of state government, one of the things we did, I think is a major thing to deal with the regions, is dealing in the areas, large areas that aren't student-oriented, IT, payroll, and purchasing. those, they're going to be working with Department of Administrative Services to come up with the best way to do that. So they're not only are they going to be working with the regents together, but also with the Department of Administrative Services. So that's in place. They're already moving forward on that and working on a report. They've already had several meetings. That's something I worked on last year. And this is sort of a sea change. I mean, before the regents sort of worked on their own, and they were working collaboratively with UNI, Iowa, and Iowa State, but now this will be also a state government. So if we could actually do it with state government combined with the regents to talk about what's the best way to do purchasing, the best way to do payroll or IT, those sort of areas, I think it makes a lot of sense.
Can you see a day when there's one president as opposed to three?
No. I think what happens there is you end up with even larger infrastructure bureaucracy. I mean, if you look at Wisconsin or some other places where they have all these different branches across the state, then you have this huge infrastructure maybe out of Madison that you're just adding additional bureaucracy. And I think that the, you know, obviously any place can be more efficient, but I think we have really good presidents in place right now at UNI, Iowa and Iowa State, and they're doing a good job. And I think we'll continue to look for more efficiencies, but I don't think I think we need to keep looking at those areas that I've outlined before and maybe some other areas.
I want to list a couple of more, but right before I do that, do you envision Representative Kaufman, one president, one bureaucracy overseeing all three branches or all three universities?
The Republicans aren't necessarily focusing on one president, but we're focusing perhaps on one assistant, one public relations officer, things like that. I mean, last year, Janine, in the same month that the Board of Regents increased tuition, they hired a new communications officer for $250,000. That's an inefficiency that's very hard to justify to Iowans. So I don't know. I don't necessarily think that we need to focus on the president. Maybe that's not the way to go. Maybe Senator Dvorsky is correct. But there are some inefficiencies in there. And quite frankly, we don't really believe that the regents and the universities are listening to us about the seriousness of wanting them to find these inefficiencies.
All right, let me listen.
I think that last one sort of falls into the, you know, I'm the world's greatest comedian. Why is that timing? You know, type situation. The timing was just bad on what they did. I think that opening, for example, had been there for a number of years and was needed to be filled, but the timing just wasn't good. So you're correct. I mean, sometimes the regents, the timing isn't the best and the way they do things aren't best. But I think if you look at actually what the structure is and everything, they are fairly efficient. And you have to also understand that the University of Iowa is one of the largest employers in the state. Maybe you ought to look at some of the other large employers and see what kind of administration they have also. So it's a big operation, and there's always room for efficiency, but we don't want to get too carried away.
All right. Let me talk about some of the other items on the list of reductions proposed. Eliminating funding for smoking prevention and cessation programs, save about $6.7 million a year. Prohibit new land acquisition by the DNR, which is the Department of Natural Resources. Eliminate state-funded preschool, which is about $70 million a year, at least right now. I know it would ratchet up. Senator Kaufman, why get rid of that?
We're trying to find savings in state government. Right now, there's $500 million built into this bill. These are ideas, the recommendations of the appropriations chair in round one of, I'm sure, a multi-round battle. These are what we propose. If there are some things in this area, we believe that the DNR has enough land at this point. In fact, I'm personally appalled by the DNR having eminent domain authority to take more land. So these ideas, the gel, the Just Eliminate Lies.
Which is an anti-smoking youth campaign.
The anti-smoking youth campaign. We're certainly, and I know in the political arena how this is going to be framed.
Yeah, it looks like, I'm just going to play devil's advocate with you. Well, they want to take rid of, child preschool for kids and smoking cessation programs, or you know, the teenage smoking prevention programs, looks anti-kid. Is that what you do? You worry about that?
Sure. I think once Iowans hear the anecdotes, once Iowans hear how some of these dollars have been made, and once Iowans realize that we're not against youth movements, against smoking, we just are looking for areas in state government where we believe the goals can still continue, but do not necessarily have to have state funding. Preschool is a perfect example. That is absolutely round one. That's saying time out. We cannot sustain adding statewide preschool on the K-12 funding formula. We have to find a different way to fund preschool. If the ideas that we put forth aren't good ones, then what are the alternatives and how do we reach that $500 million figure?
Senator Dvorsky, I know that the preschool program, the state-funded preschool program, was a big deal to Governor Culver. Is it a big deal to Senate Democrats?
Oh, of course. And it's also a big deal to school districts. We're going around, and when we meet with various school districts around the state, there's a lot of support out there for for preschool. Brain research shows that's how important that is, and it really makes a lot of sense. Really getting rid of preschool is sort of like eating your seed corn. It doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, that's the foundation to better learning for kids K through 12. And we're certainly open to looking at ways to be more efficient and how to do it maybe better or whatever. But
is that something that should be needs-based? Is there a concern about the escalating cost of that as more children are brought on, as more districts take advantage of the program? Should it, instead of be a universal program, should it be needs-based?
Well, the question is, K through 12 isn't needs-based, so why should preschool be that way? If you look at a fundamental I want to look at the system, and Representative Kaufman should look at it this way also. Preschool K through 14, look at all the way K through 12, and then community colleges or some other 2 years of training. So that's what we ought to be looking at and moving this forward, not backward. I think that all the research and everything tells us that we ought to be looking at preschool and put that in the K through 12 system. So it's public education, should be universal.
Want to open this up to your ideas and concerns. 1-866-780-9100. You're listening to The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. If you'd like to ask a question of Representative Kaufman or Senator Dvorsky, give us a call at 1-866-780-9100. Going down the list of some other reductions, eliminate the Power Fund and the Office of Energy Independence. The Power Fund was Governor Culver's big sort of grant and loan program to renewable energy projects. Also eliminate the Rebuild Iowa office. That was the office set up after the floods of 2008 to sort of coordinate relief efforts. Eliminate the Save Our Small Business Fund, which was about a $4 million fund to provide loans and grants to small businesses. Representative Kaufman, some would say, well, in a time we're trying to create jobs, don't these things do that, or do they not?
The Small Business Fund has been grossly underutilized. And quite frankly, I think there was more political points to be scored of putting that into law in the very, very last, the few last waning hours of the legislature than thoroughly thought through policy. So if you look at the underutilization of that fund, I think we would be remiss, even in good budget year, not to take a look at that. In terms of the Power Fund, there shouldn't be any surprises here. I am taken back by the amount of extremely pro-renewable energy Democrats that are talking to me about this fund has not been, the accountability is terrible, and has not been administered in a way that even remotely approaches what we would expect out of taxpayer-funded programs. And so all of these particular programs, we're looking for review. There's nothing surprising here. Every single item in this particular budget has either been voted on already or has been an amendment and has been on a House Republican website, in some cases, for almost 2 years.
Let me ask you, when you talk about that, you know, though the state has made leaps and bounds in renewable energy, are you saying that the state shouldn't be maybe helping to finance that industry, or is it should be done in a different way, or what's the Republican view on that?
Oh, definitely the latter. Republicans have been there every step of the way in terms of promotion of wind energy and promotion of our ethanol and biodiesel credits. Certainly there's more than one way to skin a cat, so to speak. So for instance, we've been very strongly in favor of biodiesel incentives. We haven't been in favor of the mandates. No, the problem with the Power Fund, Janine, is not the sincere goals of the Power Fund. Republicans are behind that. It's the actual way that it's being administered. And the accountability on this is beyond the minimum expectations of anyone, in my opinion.
Senator Dvorsky, are you one of the Democrats, he says, is concerned about the administration of that grant and loan program? Has it been maybe as forthright or managed as well as it ought to be?
Well, I think the biggest problem with the Power Fund is maybe a description of what it was. Initially, it was to provide jobs and this type of thing and get provide renewable fuels and other operations. And it's worked in a lot of different areas, but maybe we ought to look at that as maybe a broader economic development picture. I mean, basically, this is a Governor Culver initiative, so he lost, so we're not going to, you know, pursue that anymore. But I think
the maybe
goal
isn't surprising.
Yeah, it's a political situation, but the goal of it, I'm glad that the House Republicans are talking about the goal of it's important. And I know the governor's elect is talking about maybe putting in under economic development or something else. And you know, we're certainly happy to look at it that way and move it forward. But the idea of a green state and renewable fuels capital of the United States, that makes a lot of sense, I think. And I think we need to pursue those goals and see how we can do that. And if it involves a different structure, then fine. They talked about Rio. It was Rebuild Iowa office. It was set to go out of business anyway. So was the Power Fund. But
even sunset dates are often, things are continued beyond what their original, you know, we put a program in place for a few years. I mean, it seems like Vision Iowa probably had an end date initially as well. And isn't some of those grant programs continuing today? CAT, the Community Attraction and Tourism Fund, those programs go on longer than their initial.
Well, that would take action by the legislature to do that. But, I mean, there is a Sunset and Rebuild Iowa program, and the Power Fund wasn't going to be, you know, necessarily move forward either. So, you know, there's a lot of politics and all this, but we certainly want to look at the programs that benefit small business. And Representative Kaufman's right about this, our small business fund there. It hasn't been utilized. We ought to figure out some way so we can get money to small businesses and figure out some way to deal with that.
All right. Let's go to our phones now. Let's talk to Gene in Iowa City. Gene, thanks so much for calling the Exchange today.
Yeah, hi. I'm wondering if your guests could comment on, I've heard that the Republicans are going to try to even ease gun control laws in Iowa even more than they are now. And at least in Johnson County, I think there's a big change this year because our sheriff can no longer deny permits to carry concealed weapons. And in lieu of the shootings in Arizona, I'm just wondering, you know, one, if they're still going to pursue that, and two, if they do, is there a way that they can make it easier for citizens to view who has those permits so we can know which of our neighbors are possibly carrying?
All right. Let me start with you, Representative Kaufman. Large gun legislation last year, and that's not common just because it is difficult. Do you see new gun legislation this year?
I see certainly that there are going to be bills that move towards, there's a lot of names for it, but the Alaska Plan, which essentially, first of all, I would correct the premise of the caller. The county sheriffs can deny. They have to give reasons for doing that. In the past, we had situations where sheriffs were denying unreasonably.
Now there's a list, right? I mean, they can't deny for just anything. Most people will qualify.
Exactly. Yes. And you know, and I understand that the Johnson County Sheriff has been saying that this is a bad thing. But I can show you the Democratic Muscatine County Sheriff and the Republican Cedar County Sheriff who broke ranks with the sheriff's decision and went up and was with Governor Culver when they signed it and heralded this as a great law. So the premise of the question of skepticism of the current law, I think it was actually a positive step forward. And there's an example of a Democratic and a Republican sheriff that would agree with me in terms of more legislation. Yes, there was more legislation last year. There were people that want to go further, that want to move towards an Alaska-type plan.
Which is?
Essentially, a person has the right to carry with the exception if there is a criminal record, a criminal background. The other thing that this new law has done, and I would hope that would remain, and this is just personally for me, is the training standards. We had some aberrations in training in the old system that we had that we do not now. Now you have an NRA-certified instructor. So it passed overwhelmingly. Both parties supported it. A Democratic governor signed it into law. Yes, I think there's going to be a continued push.
Mm-hmm. Senator Dvorsky, any concerns about that continued push? And then after that, any concerns for safety here at the State House in light of the Arizona shooting? Now, I realize that was a congressperson, not a statewide elected official, but does it come into your consciousness at all?
Sure. And I'd like to comment, my friend Sheriff Pokrobic in Johnson County has a lot of concerns about this and wasn't in favor of the bill. And I also represent Linn County, and our sheriff there didn't have as many concerns before the bill passed. Now he has a lot of concerns on how to implement it. And I think that's something we need to look at. We might need to refine that a little bit and try and deal with that. And to the concerns, unfortunately, that the situation in Arizona, I think one of the things we really need to look at in this carry law is the idea of somebody packing or bringing guns into a city council meeting or a school board meeting or things like that. We need to look at that and maybe have some restrictions there. That really makes a lot of sense. Maybe in the Capitol here and that kind of thing. I think maybe it's covered under, I'm not sure. But we need to look at all that and we need to have some discretion there. I really think that could be a problem. And if some of us who from southeastern Iowa remember when Mayor King was gunned down at a city council.
In Mount Pleasant.
In Mount Pleasant in his city council. And then... the next mayor was Tom Vilsack, who was our governor. But I think this really does bring up a situation where we need to look at the law and see if there is some way that we can have some provisions in place, because we want to make sure we have people who want to serve on these boards, commissions, and city councils, and they need to be safe and protected.
I know it just happened, and this is Iowa, and people feel pretty safe here, but any concerns about your own personal safety as you're out on the campaign trail? I mean, you don't want to limit your availability to your constituents, I can imagine.
Well, certainly. I mean, anytime you see a tragedy such as Arizona, I mean, as a human being, you reflect on yourself, and especially when you're dealing with a situation in Arizona that does not seem to be politically motivated. I mean, this person's reading the Communist Manifesto. I mean, these ideas that the right somehow is instigated is inherently unfair and ludicrous. And so I'm obviously concerned as a human being. I don't know what we can do to prevent someone that does not have all of their mental faculties.
All right. Representative Kaufman, thank you for your time. Senator Dvorsky, thank you so much for
being here.
You've been listening to The Exchange, produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer, with assistance from Mitchell Schmidt. Jeff Schmidt is our executive producer, and technical support comes from Dennis Reese and John Pemble. I'm Janine Beck. This is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for listening.